Radio Real. Real radio, your reality.
Welcome to Off the Shelf,
the Second Life radio show and podcast about books and the people who love them.
I'm Kegia Girardi.
And this is Simeon Beresford.
Join us as we survey the literary scene in our virtual world. Welcome to Off the Shelf. Simeon is back with us this episode. And he's also on mute, which is why we can't hear him. But today we have with us a guest who not only writes science fiction novels, but also Westerns, Robert Vardaman, or Carl Lassiter, as he's also known. Hi, Bob, and welcome to Off the Shelf.
Oh, hi there.
Hi, Bob, from me as well. Here.
I finally found my mute button. Hello, Bob.
Hey, Simeon, how are you doing?
Not very well, but I'm sure we'll get better. So you've written over 200 novels, but in your early years, it was rather hard to get anything in print at all, wasn't it? Was there anything special about the ones that made it to print? Or was it a matter of just keeping on slogging until they finally published something?
I never really had any problem getting started with the publishing. A friend got me involved in writing back in the mid-70s. This was a wonderful time to be a new writer. The Conan, Edgar Rice Burroughs flood, I guess, had hit, and fantasy novels were really big. I sold a fantasy novel to Dell, sold a science fiction novel to a company called Major Books, which was a minor publisher. Mm-hmm. And then my friend George Proctor and I sold a series of fantasies to Ace Books, and it really took off for me from there. I was doing some of the Nick Carter Killmaster books. I was doing other series books, and I got started in Westerns in 1984.
That was, I had the impression that you've been pushing out some short stories for a while before your first novel, and they kept coming. They kept saying, "Yes, we'll accept it," and then the people behind it would fold before they printed, and you do the whole thing.
Hmm? Well, George Proctor had written several short stories and a novel. He was a reporter for the Dallas Morning News at the time. We wrote a story, and he's the one that said, "Come on, you can co-author this. Let's do it." And it sold. It sold to James Gunn and Fred Pohl's magazine. Don't even remember the name of it. It was Payment on Publication. The magazine folded before we got paid. No. Well, George said, "This is one of the things that happens in publishing." And he sent it out again, sent it to another magazine that folded before it was published. He kept it in a shoebox for a long time, and when the World Science Fiction Convention was in New Orleans, they were going to do a little tabloid and wanted short stories. He sent it in. They liked it. They bought it, meaning on publication we would get money. What happened there, of course, was they never published it. We never got money for it. The irony of this is it was 20 years worth of submissions, and the short story was called A Killing in the Market.
Well, it seems to kill the market.
We managed to kill at least three markets, and I hold this in reserve now so that if there's any market you want dead, I can sit this off.
That was definitely the kiss of death. I know that from your bio that you also were nominated for a Hugo Award at some point for your fanzine work. What were you writing? Short stories?
I did my own fanzine back in the late 60s and early 70s and 1972 at the first LA Con. I was nominated for Best Fan Writer. And I have to admit that I certainly lost to one of the greats in the field, Harry Warner. So that was no problem at all for me to pass that one along. But alas, I have not been nominated professionally for any Hugo or Nebula.
Yeah, I was saying this to Kay. She was saying, of course, he was writing stories in his fanzine. I said, no, fanzines are all book reviews and gossip. It's all about what authors you've propped up the bar with. So, was your fanzine all gossip?
Absolutely not. My fanzine was named Sandworm. Dune was and is still my favorite science fiction book. And the topics were wide-ranging. It wasn't just hard science fiction that I dealt with. I had quite a variety of people writing in. Dean Koontz did a column for me for a few issues. Bob Tucker did. Bob Block wrote some stuff. Ted White. I had quite an array of people that were...
Yes. No wonder you got... No wonder you got nominated for a Hugo.
Well, it was for my fan writing rather than the fanzine, so that's a double treat, I guess, for me.
Yeah. If you stood out in that crowd, you must have been good.
Well,
sorry, I want to move on to the next question now for no real reason. I was going to ask, how did you find yourself writing westerns? It's a bit of a jump. It seems like that now, I think. I'm not sure it was at the time. But what made you wander into westerns?
Well, let me go way, way, way back to when I started reading science fiction when I was 8, 9 years old. We lived in El Paso, and they have a fabulous library system. It was the Carnegie Grant. I was working my way through all of the juvenile science fiction, and my eyes turned to the adult section, you know, the Asimov and the Clarks and the Heinleins. Well, my mother had to check those out because they were in the adult section. The librarian realized that my mother's taste ran more to Zane Grey than it did to Isaac Asimov. And I was given my very own card to be able to check out adult stuff with the proviso that it was only from the science fiction section. Well, more often than not, I would go there and check out stuff for my mother also. And I read one or two of the Zane Greys, and they were okay. I enjoyed them, but flash forward to 1984. I had been with my agent for about 3 years then, and he mentioned that Berkeley Books was looking for another writer in one of their action Western series and wanted to know if I would be interested. I thought about it for a little while and thought, sure, I can write these. I enjoyed reading one or two way back in the day. I wrote Slocum and the Tong Warriors back in 1984, and that was 105 Jake Logan books ago. I just turned in the latest one, which is Slocum and the Lady Detective. Mm-hmm. And that was... my introduction to the Westerns, and then in 1989, I started looking at writing Westerns under my own pen name. Mm-hmm. I chose Carl Lasseter for a lot of reasons, but the primary one is, who is the best-selling Western writer ever? Louis L'Amour. If you're looking for a Louis L'Amour book, you start down the L-A, and you get to the end, and here's Lasseter, L-A-S-S-I-T-E-R. So I figured that was a good place to put my books on the shelf if I had to have a pen name.
And very smart.
I kind of made it before the L'Amour, because I can't even imagine them getting to L'Amour and stopping.
Yeah, this is modern day marketing, I guess, in one respect. More often than not, I've gone into a bookstore and asked where the Western section is. They say the Louis L'Amour books are over there.
But
the Carl Lasseter books are pretty good-sized epic Westerns about the Navajo's Long Walk, about the Victoria War, big things at Bent's Fort, those kinds of things. And just recently, in fact, the book I'm working on right now is called The Sonora Noose, and it will be under a new pen name. And this series of books, the pen name is Jackson Lowry. You might notice that the last name Lowry is chosen exactly the same way that I did Lasseter. Yes. I want to be on the same shelf as Louis L'Amour. But this one is a more traditional shoot 'em up Western. It's about a federal deputy marshal, and he's down in southern New Mexico coping with problems back then. They're probably not too dissimilar than problems right now. Bandits coming over the border.
Mm-hmm. How much research do you end up doing for your Westerns and also for your science fiction novels?
Well, for the Westerns, I have got two floor-to-the-ceiling bookshelves full of research material. For the science fiction, it depends entirely on how hard the science is. I have a bachelor's degree in physics and a master's in materials engineering. So absorbing a lot of the science fictional stuff is not that hard for me. But keeping up with it these days is really, really difficult. The pace that knowledge is being accumulated scientifically is more than any one or any thousand people could ever keep up with. But as far as how much, that depends entirely on the project. It's, I rather flippantly say, enough. How much is enough as well? Depends entirely on how interested I get in the minutia.
Does your home in Albuquerque help inspire the Westerns at all with the landscape or even the history of the area?
Oh, absolutely. I've set quite a few of the Carl Lasseter Westerns here. Not quite so many of the Jake Logans. One of the strangest things, about 5 or 6 years ago, I thought the Jake Logan series was going to bite the dust or ride off into the sunset, however you want to look at it. So I wrote a book called Slocum's Last Gasp, and it was set in Albuquerque. Somehow, when the book was published, it was translated to Albuquerque, Colorado, which has always amused me somewhat.
Tells is there me actually, lot. Is there an Albuquerque, Colorado?
Not that I'm aware of. There certainly is an El Paso County in Colorado, but not an Albuquerque. The thing that I've enjoyed the most was telling people, well, you know, surely this helps on the Westerns. Yes, it helps on the Westerns, but it helps even more on the science fiction. I can look out my window, describe what I see, and editors in New York City think I'm describing an alien planet.
When you're doing stuff, you've done a lot of stuff for Star Trek, Tom Swift, and so on. Do you have to particularly research those to make sure that you don't tread on the other writer's toes?
On the Star Trek books, I was very lucky. Dave Hartwell had approached me about writing a book back in 80 or so, right after Bantam lost the license to Simon & Schuster. And it turns out that the Klingon Gambit was the first of the Star Trek books that Hartwell bought. It turned out that it was the third one published because Roddenberry's novelization for the first Star Trek movie came out as number one, and Vonda McIntyre had killed off Kirk and had been splashed all over, so help me, the National Enquirer. So that was the second book. And about a year after that, Hartwell came back and said, well, we wanted another one. Well, I'd done two proposals, and he'd chosen the Klingon Gambit. Went ahead and did the second one, which ended up as number 12. So I was really in an excellent position here. I didn't have 500 or 1,000 other authors' books to worry about. The Bantam books I consider to be rather inferior because all of them read as if somebody had not sold another science fiction book, just went through and changed the names of Spock and Kirk and McCoy and dumped it on the desk. But the Tom Swift books were entirely different. I had read the Tom Swift Jr. books when I was a kid. In fact, the very first book I ever read was Tom Swift and the Flying Lab. I was in Cub Scouts, and we had a project of, oh, horror of horrors, to read a book. And the first three of those in the Tom Swift Jr. series had been published for $1. You know, 33 and a third cents per hardcover book sounds pretty amazing today. It was okay back then. I read it. I loved it. That's really what got me going on science fiction. And then I went back and picked up a lot of the Tom Swift Sr. books. And when I heard that they were talking about reviving the series, I found out that Bill Rotzler was the driving force behind that. And I talked to him in 1984, I guess, at, again, it was an L.A. convention at Worldcon. And he put me together with the editor, who was Harriet Adams. She was Edward Stratemeyer's daughter, and Stratemeyer was the one that had started Tom Swift and the Hardy Boys and, you know, Don Sturdy and, you know, about 400 other series. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really have to do much background there because it was a completely new space opera. It was set in space, had new characters. It was nothing to do with Tom Swift or Tom Swift Jr., except a name. And they pulled the plug on the series after, I think, 7 or 8 books. And then about 10 years, 15 years later, Byron Price started up the Tom Swift franchise once more. I got in there and did 2 of the books, The Microbots and Mutant Beach. For some reason, they had me pegged as doing the little itty-bitty shrunk, you know, the incredible shrinking man things, and, oh boy, the giant behemoth-type things. And both of those are pretty close to what I wrote. And those books, I think, did okay, but... And in the latest Tom Swift series, the Tom Swift Young Inventor, I made a pitch to write a book, but it's my understanding all of those were done in-house. So I didn't do any of those.
How do you take a character like Tom Swift, who's had such a long history, and reinvent him for the latest version of the series?
That was especially a problem in the fourth series, the Mutant Beach and Microbots, because they still wanted the inventor feel to it, and yet the characters had to be 20th century, late 20th century. And it was mostly a matter of, I was lucky at the time I could listen to my son, who was almost the right age for that book series, and sort of get a feel for what he was talking about, what he was looking at. And I put that in as much as I possibly could.
So he's your best research subject for the Tom Swift books.
At the time, he sure was. Now he's reading things that astound me and I would never try to duplicate. He's finishing off his junior year. He's got a double major in psychology and English, and he's taking a course in Thomas Pynchon and DeLillo, I think is the name. And I'm thinking, oh, God, I remember reading Gravity Rainbow and, you know, Crying of Lot 49 and so forth. That is the kind of thing he reads for pleasure. So I think he's far beyond ever giving me any ideas for Tom Swift, young inventor type things.
Well, we're going to give Bob a chance to catch his breath, and we're going to listen to I Wish I Could Write Lyrics Like Bob Dylan by Bernshee Thornside from Magnatune.com.
Bob, you're right. I wish I could be cool like Marlon Brando, mesmerizing star upon the screen. I wish I could look good like Elvis Presley, delivering my lines like Martin Sheen. Things they do look so simple, so simple without compare. And even if I practice for hours, I still can't dance like Fred Astaire. I wish I could be cool like Marlon Brando. I wish I had the gift of getting.
And welcome back. So, Bob, you're doing a lot of science fiction and a lot of fantasy. Do you differentiate between the two?
Oh, absolutely.
Nowadays, we see so much stuff called speculative fiction, and I don't really care. But you're more old school.
I see a vast difference between the two. Science fiction is explicable by some natural law and repeatable. On the other hand, fantasy can operate on any given set of rules, but they can be made up and have nothing whatsoever to do with the reality around us. I tend to like heroic fantasy, which is the sword and sorcery type. You know, I think the epitome of that was done by Fritz Leiber with the Gray Mouser series.
Yes.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your writing process. You're obviously a prolific writer if you have over 200 books in publication. I imagine that makes you a very disciplined writer as well. What's your typical routine?
It's been changing for the last year or two. I'm starting to write more short stories than before, simply because I'm going more and more to the electronic publishing, the e-books, putting them up on the iTunes store, on the Kindle, places like that. But nowadays I get up and sometimes it's an hour and a half, 2 hours to get all of the email and prettying up, I guess, online done. And by 9 or 10 o'clock, I start writing and can, I usually write in about 15 or 20 minute bursts, get up, take a break, walk around, come back and do it all over again. In a really good day, I can get maybe 6,000 words done now. Way back in the day, surprisingly enough, when I was using the typewriter, I was doing 10,000 words a day. But the idea of doing, I call that about 20 pages. That will knock out a Western, for instance, in about 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks.
The fastest writer I ever knew was Lionel Fanthorpe, who was known to write 3 novels in a week.
I have got to ask, is there really a Lionel Fanthorpe?
Yeah, I've got very drunk at his house, so I can assure you that he exists.
Okay, there's a recommendation for you.
Wow. I don't think he writes anything at bat speed nowadays, so it was when he was young and foolish.
Bob, you just... Go ahead.
Some of my writers that I truly admire, writers from the 30s and 40s like Lester Dent and Frederick Faust. Dent wrote the Doc Savage books, among others, and Frederick Faust wrote under Max Brand and a lot of other names also. And I keep thinking, these guys did it on a typewriter, amazing output, and the stories may not be well written, but by golly, they were always interesting. They always had something that would catch my imagination and carry me along. So,
storytelling is more important than literary merit, let's be honest about it.
Literary merit, no. I would rather be Edgar Rice Burroughs than F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Yes, yeah. There's 2 Burroughs in the world, and Edgar Rice is the one to follow. Who cares about William?
Yeah, I can't see Edgar Rice Burroughs writing The Naked Lunch, for instance. Though heaven alone knows, with Pride, Prejudice, and Zombies and all of these, maybe that's a brand new growth industry for fiction.
That's a thought.
It gives Tarzan a whole new view, doesn't it?
It could well.
Well, when I first met you, I was with Mike Stackpole, and I know you've collaborated with him in the past. How does working with authors and co-writing with them change the way you write?
Depends entirely on the person. I think in general, the old saw that collaboration is where you do twice the work for half the money is true. Frankly, I've lost a very good friend because of collaboration, and after many, many decades, I still don't care. On the other hand, my best friend was George Proctor. We did 9 novels together, a couple short stories. He was the one who got me started writing. And frankly, I would have been more than willing to do collaborations with him until our fingers fell off. But it's really sort of a feeling out process more than anything else. I write generally the way I worked with George, for instance. We would sit down, come up with the basic idea. I would do the synopsis. He would redo the synopsis. We would argue about it, get it squared away. Then I would do the first draft. He would do the second draft. I would pretty it up. Then he would do the copy edited side and leave me doing all of the proofing on the page proofs and so on. That worked out very, very well for us. And I can see, they would not work out well with other people that I've collaborated with or tried to collaborate with.
You also mentioned earlier that you spend a lot of time these days working on updating your email. I know you update the blog almost every day. You're somebody who tweets, which I think is just wonderful. I love it when authors do that. And you're putting your stuff on Kindle, iTunes. What do you feel? I know you are a really big supporter of electronic publishing, and I wonder how you think things are going to change for writers in the next 5 years.
We have gone from this giant monolithic publishing industry in New York, and publishing has become a cottage industry again. And I think that is a wonderful bit of progress. I coined the term vertically integrated publishing, VIPUB, during Mike Stackpole's office hours, actually. And I think this is the wave of the future. The author not only writes, goes ahead, formats it, and then has to find a venue to sell it, either online, through Kindle, iTunes, wherever. And if that goes well, then find a small press to publish a limited edition or publish it him or herself. And then the kicker is what the publishers have never really done, but I think all authors ought to, and that's publicity. It's things like this podcast. It's things like Twitter. It's Facebook. It's MySpace. The blogs. All of these are different ways of getting the name out there and perhaps enticing people to read what we have written.
That seems to be taking up that public, the publishing side, the PR side, I should say, seems to be taking up more and more time for the writers that they could be at the computer creating new fiction for us. I've heard some writers lament that. What do you think about that interpersonal connection with your fans and the time involved?
I do find it lamentable that I can't sit and write 24/7, but on the other hand, writing is a business. I have always approached it as a business and don't see any reason why businesses can't change. The big change that I am seeing is that the writers have to be more in contact with the reading audience. As such, however it takes to get out there, do it, fine. Again, I'm something of a hermit. I would prefer not to deal with people, but that's not an option anymore.
I think that's... authors in the science fiction field always did interact with their public a lot more than the most genres. So you come from that background. Weren't you in doing stuff for the Science Fiction Writers of America for a while? I bet you have more than enough about politics then.
You are breaking up. I wasn't able to catch that.
Oh, I'm sorry. I've forgotten what I was saying.
He was. You mentioned that because of science fiction, it's always been one of those genres that has really connected with its fans from the beginning, versus other genres that tend to be more reclusive. So it may not be as difficult for other science fiction writers.
It's one of those things where I honestly don't see how an extrovert can be a writer. It must drive them crazy to sit there for more than 10 or 15 minutes and realize that nobody's around. They have to share. Let's put it this way. I had some unfortunate experiences when I was in graduate school as far as the public speaking went. And when I got out into being a writer, I realized this had to quit. I had to learn to do public speaking. I had to get out, meet people, and I have. There's no problem. I've given talks in front of 2,000 and 3,000 people. Not a problem. On the other hand, do I like it? No. After a convention, I have to go and sort of decompress and get my energy back. The difference between that, which is introvert, and an extrovert, the extrovert goes and talks to people and feels energized, not depleted. So it's one of those things where I do it. I like it, sort of, but mostly it takes me a while to recuperate from liking it.
Yeah.
I understand.
You like the party, but you get the hangover.
Yeah, exactly.
Bob, I noticed that your web address is... let me see if I can pronounce this correctly. CenotaphRoad.com. I'm guessing that that series is especially significant to you.
Yeah, that was a series that I did, the first big series that I did back in 1980 or so, that really got me launched as a solid writer. As such, I've always had a warm spot in my heart for it. I liked the books. I think David Mattingly did the covers for all six of the books. They're fabulous covers. I love them to death. And I talked to David at a convention once, and he says, "I hope I never have to do another spider again." the giant spider was one of the characters. And he had been hired by Avon a few years later to do the covers for my Masters of Space. The second one in there is a picture of a guy hanging from a spider web with a giant spider over him. So poor David did indeed get stuck with doing another spider for me. But yes, the Santaf Road is an interesting name. It's one of those things that I think is iconic in its own way. And again, they sold well. They got me going, and I love the series dearly.
And notice how skillfully we worked it into the interview to give it a plug.
Thank you very much.
Which means that it's now time for you to start plugging all the works that you're bringing out in the near future. What's due out?
Okay. A minor nonfiction thing is a month from today, on May 25th, Planet Stories is reprinting Piers Anthony's Sews the Rope. I did the introduction for that. Then the big one is a book that I co-authored with Matthew Stover. It's a novelization of the Sony PlayStation video game God of War. And that's a big time release. I recently signed the contract for God of War 2, and I'm the only one that will be writing on that. The reason I'd gotten into being a co-author with Matt on the first one, he had contracted for the book, and health problems prevented him from finishing it. So I went ahead and picked up the reins and ran with everything to finish off the book. And they liked what I did. I got the co-authorship on it, and, you know, off I go. Coming up in short stories will be a steampunk anthology called Steampunked. Martin Greenberg and Gene Raby are the editors on that. I have a steampunk story in there called The Transmogrification Ray. And it's got all your typical steampunk elements in it. I had a great fun writing it. It's got guys with goggles and strange experiments, and it's got an airship, and it's got a steam-powered dog. It's got everything in it. Oh, and the steam-powered dog's name, of course, is Fulton.
Oh, perfect.
But, you know, I'm doing other things with Mike Stackpole. We have been talking about this for a long time, and Mike is launching off what he calls the Chain Story Project. A lot of authors will be doing stories in a never-ending chain. All of them are set at a mythical Wanderers Club in the 1880s. And they would open with something boilerplate. Well, Professor Challenger, that's an interesting story. However, my story of, and then it'd launch into the story, and then end with something that would give indication of who the next author in the chain would be. The idea is that these stories will be free. We will put them out there. People can come in and join the chain at any place. You can read, you can write stories for the chain. Looks like a whole lot of fun for a lot of people there. Other things, I'm always doing things. I feel very, very guilty about not finishing off an audiobook for a friend in Florida. He wanted a weird Western, and I have gotten the first 10 pages of an hour's worth of script done and have not been able to get back to working on that. I really need to, and I've got other projects that are in the works, but primarily is finishing off the Sonora Noose right now and then doing the God of War 2. As far as other projects, I co-edited a huge anthology with Joan Saberhagen called Golden Reflections. It will be out from Bain Books later this year. The idea there was to take Fred Saberhagen's book, The Mask of the Sun, which is a time travel, time war story, and get seven novellas from really top-notch writers and have them all tie in somehow to this time war. We've got Harry Turtledove and David Weber, and we've got a lot of really, really good people in this anthology. I was very happy to do it.
See, Bob is actually an alien, and he only requires 30 minutes of sleep a night.
Oh, I wish. I wish. I'm just now getting ready. This is one of my sidelines. For 6 years, I have been on the editorial staff of four fantasy football magazines, and we're just getting ready to gear up, I hope, for another year of those. And, it's football diehards and so forth. But if you're in fantasy football, don't ask me what's going on. I've done this for 6 years. I don't follow football. I don't really know what this is all about.
I love it. All right. Well, Bob, thank you so much for being on Off the Shelf. We have really enjoyed talking with you.
Well, thank you so much for having me here.
Off the Shelf is produced for Radio Real by Kegia Girardi and Simeon Beresford. Technical production is by Radio Real. You can find Radio Real on the web at radioreal.org. Music on this program includes works by artists on the Magnatune label. The music in the general introduction is John Playford's All in a Garden Green by Eileen Hadidian and Natalie Cox from their album Dolce Musica, A Contemplative Journey. The off-the-shelf theme music is 1500 Tons by Burning Babylon from the album Stereo Mashup. And we bid you goodbye with this piece, Hagagasan 14, by Eternal Jazz Project, from their album, Gratis Jazz. You can learn more about Magnatune and their artists on their website at magnatune.com. Off the Shelf is licensed under Creative Commons.